Today's guest says that we have yet to comprehend the meaning of universal digital connection and its impact on our psychology. Today's guest further goes on to say that America is at a crossroads, contending with our overreaction to terrorism and allowing the beginnings of a police state. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, and I am delighted to welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. William Keller. Dr. Keller, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Now, you have worn many hats. You've served as a security analyst in the United States Congress for 10 years, executive director of the Center for International Studies at MIT. The list kind of goes on and on. What brings you to write Democracy Betrayed?
Well, Pamela, the book is really a broadside against what I see as the excesses of counterterrorism and of the intelligence community, especially since 9/11. And I believe that this is eroding our civil liberties and our freedoms. We've got a lot to lose because basic democratic values like privacy and rule of law are at stake. And so the book describes the rise of a surveillance security state that is replacing liberal democracy, the democracy that was contemplated by Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson.
You begin your book with a quote that I'm going to ask you to reflect upon today. The quote is that history tells us that great leaders arise when the public is in peril. Have great leaders arisen today? Is the Republic in peril now?
That's really a good question. When I wrote that, I thought primarily of some of our founding fathers, and like George Washington, who was so influential in bringing the state back together again, bringing the country together. There were lots of instances where people didn't get paid, soldiers didn't get paid, they became uproarious, and he had a way of bringing things together and making people compromise. Abraham Lincoln rose to the challenge of slavery and the Civil War, and so the country was indeed coming apart, you know, an internal revolution going on, a separatist movement, and Lincoln was able to pull it back together again. And I think of the third example that we have is of Franklin Roosevelt, who really took the reins of power when we were in a deep, deep depression, something that our parents remember and we don't. And then of course, the World War II. So these have really been three areas where our state seemed to be coming apart or something was changing fundamentally. I believe that we're entering a period of security-dominated democracy. And I don't see that our present leaders, either from the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, or certainly not Donald Trump, have the ability to look deeply into the intelligence agencies and look deeply into the hundreds of thousands of people who have been hired to conduct security policy internally in the United States. And I don't think they get it. I think they're just out to lunch and very slowly and quietly. I believe the intelligence part of our government is taking over many of the reins of government.
Let me ask you this. You have held the highest security clearances, and you've written extensively about the FBI defense technology, multinational corporations, intelligence community, and the arms trade. Was there any risk to you in writing this book? I mean, nowadays, you know, so many people, if they say something that somebody else doesn't like, they're called all kinds of names and all kinds of threats against society. Have you had any trouble with this, with the publication of Democracy Betrayed?
Well, not yet. Not Democracy Betrayed. And I actually think that we still do have the ability to print pretty much anything that we want. But I did have a problem in Turkey once where I gave a talk on the subject of Democracy Betrayed. And when I came down from the stage, a man grabbed me by the collar and tried to beat me up, but fortunately the Turkish police took him away. So I have had one or two experiences where people were a little bit rougher than I'd like them to be. You know, I'd like to have a good, strong conversation with a lot of truth on all sides. So that was a little disconcerting, but actually for my personal safety, I'm not too concerned, actually, at this point.
Well, that's a good thing. Now, you also said, as I quoted you in the very beginning, that you are concerned that we as a people are not as aware as we ought to be with respect to the digital connection and how it impacts our psychology and indeed our society. Can you say more about that concern?
Yeah, that's a great area to think about. We have two things happening at the same time, and one, the first, is the digital revolution, the revolution in communications. You know, 20 years ago, nobody could possibly, maybe Steve Jobs, but nobody in the general public could possibly have thought that we would all be carrying around these iPhones and other brands of smartphones where we could do our banking, we could communicate in ways by texting and through various apps, WhatsApp and so on, that people couldn't even think about. Well, so in the short space of a few years, a couple of decades, we've revolutionized the entire way we communicate, the way we work, even the way what we have in cars has become digital. And so has surveillance. And so what we have is a confluence of events. We have 9/11 beginning at the beginning of the century, pretty much. And then at the same time, the rise of Silicon Valley and surveillance capability, where the semiconductor industry has just exploded all over the world. So these two events, the fact that we have this digital revolution that we don't really understand, and the rise of security, deep security within all the modern liberal states. And this is not just happening in the United States, and I'll be glad to describe what's happening in the United States later, but a couple weeks ago I was in Britain when the Manchester event occurred, the terrorist event occurred, and I think as a result of that and a smaller event, Theresa May, their prime minister, is now going to really clamp down, and they're going to really try to control the internet. So the concern is that people make all kinds of statements. They do all kinds of things that then become recorded by the digital space, and that somehow the governments have gained access to this space. So that it's very hard to speak and think freely when it's pretty clear that if you're thinking about anything that's out of line at all, or out of the party line, you may well be recorded.
So you're painting, every paranoid person's nightmare, that it may not be safe to say what you think. It certainly may not be safe to say it to certain folks. Where is democracy in that? In that space of time where what you say is recorded and potentially then later on used against you?
Oh, what a great question. Democracy depends on a couple of ideas that we don't talk about very much. And one is the idea of association and privacy. If we're really going to have a democracy, people have to be able to get together and say whatever they want to say to one another, and feel free to talk about it and really have it out in politics. And that's the way we sort of forge consensus in our society, and it's the way we get good laws and not secret laws. So what concerns me is a couple of things are going on here. One is people are afraid to speak their mind in certain instances, and secondly, because it may be in fact recorded. So I think we are very slowly eroding some of the real principles of democracy. Now, let me give you a kind of a harder-edged example of how this works. We've had these wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq for as long as a lot of people, younger people, can certainly remember. And as these wars have wound down, and they go up and down, but as they wind down, they sort of slough off a lot of really high-powered military equipment. And the government the federal government has taken these military equipment, including armored cars and helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft and all kinds of high-powered guns, and given them to the local police forces. And the local police forces have organized SWAT teams all over the country. Now, I have to tell you that in 1965, there were no SWAT teams.
None.
And now, none. They came as a result of the Watts riot. Somebody had a great idea to put together a fast reaction, very powerful, forceful entry team. So, you know, these SWAT stands for special weapons and technology and tactics. I'm sorry, special weapons and tactics. Well, now they have their special weapons. And that's why, you know, when we have terrorist suspects who start shooting, they're almost always killed, because the police are so highly armed. And this is also played out in some of the racial conflict we've had in our cities, where the police, you know, if you're carrying a 36 revolver, you shoot somebody, it's probably not going to kill them, unless you hit them. If you're carrying a 9mm pistol, it is going to kill them, if it shoots semi-automatically. So we see that the local communities, the police have become much, much tougher than when we were younger, and they have much stronger weapons, and they have a tremendous surveillance capability. And indeed, some of the large police forces, like the Los Angeles Police Force and the New York Police Force, and God knows we need them, but they have communications and counterterrorism centers that coordinate internationally. So this is a very strange thing, that our local police have been made the sort of tip of the spear of counterterrorism in our own country. And of course, you know, I think that finding a terrorist is a little like finding a needle in a haystack. First, you have to line up all the straws,
right,
and know exactly what's going on, and then you can find that needle.
And you know, I think about certainly the communities of color that are feeling, and reasonably so, quite at risk. And as you talk about the various SWAT teams that abound and how they're able to surveil and connect, it gets to be that much more troublesome.
Right, and they just break and enter, too, as well. And many times they break and enter, and they hurt or kill the wrong person. So this is something in our society that we ought to put an end to right away, these SWAT teams.
Well, what kind of surveillance do police typically engage in?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Can you say it again?
Is there a typical method that police departments use as they are engaging in surveillance? Is it digital? Is it visual? Are there particular tools
sure,
that they use?
Oh, yeah, the police have all kinds of tools in addition to military-grade night goggles now, some of them, and they have surveillance equipment, which is very sophisticated. It's hard to say exactly what it is because it changes so quickly. But, you know, now at the local level, face recognition technology will be a reality very soon. When I was in London, I noticed that there were literally hundreds of cameras on every block. So that's a society that has become used to being looked at and observed all the time. The only problem is that when somebody commits a terrorist crime or any crime, it's always after the fact, because you can't really see them in advance. And I think this is what the technology is heading toward, trying to anticipate who might do something in our society. But then you're sort of, you know, you're forecasting the crime and then going to find a perpetrator. And when that's happened, some very strange things have happened. The FBI, for example, I won't speak about this too long, but the FBI, for example, has organized cells of jihadis, of people who would have absolutely no idea how to do it, provided them with weapons and plans and logistics. And then they go out and they try to commit the crime. The FBI stops them, and there's a great brouhaha in the press, and a terrorist event has been stopped. But in point of fact, the FBI hadn't planted the informants and given the people money and organized them and helped them think through the crime. These people probably would not have had a chance to do it. the interesting thing.
Well, it's an interesting thing, and I hate to keep using the same concept over and over again, but it really is terrifying. And you're saying, and I certainly think that what you've just described underscores that, that the threat is not so much from violent extremism as it is from our responses to what we fear may happen or happened yesterday.
Exactly. And what happened after 9/11 was that we sort of took the gloves off and we said, well, it doesn't matter how much money it takes. It doesn't matter how many people we have to employ or how many programs we have to put together or what the CIA has to do to make sure that 9/11 never, ever happens again. Now, let me be really clear that I believe 9/11 to have been one of the greatest tragedies the United States has ever had, and so we'll just get that on the table. But 9/11 had some very, very bad consequences for our society and for our governance, and one of those was the development of what I call the surveillance security state. And basically, there are 17 intelligence agencies. Then there are other units of government that get involved. And then there are high-tech companies. And they all have worked very, very closely together to build a whole counterterrorism net of great magnitude since 9/11. The budgets for all these entities have increased by about 400%, so that now we're spending something like $120 billion a year on counterterrorism and intelligence. Now, you have to stop for a minute and think what that means. I mean, if we spend $120 billion more on our schools, we could probably knock down every grade school in the country and rebuild it with state-of-the-art technology and double the teacher's salaries.
Not to mention health care.
Health care, absolutely. There are many places where we could put this money. But instead, we were putting it into hiring literally hundreds of thousands of security people. It's almost a jobs program for college graduates. As a professor at the University of Georgia, I got many of my students jobs in the intelligence community because that's what they wanted, and of course, you want to help your students.
And because they could, there were jobs to be had.
Yes, even during the downturn, the intelligence community and the agencies of government, the coercive, I like to think of it as the point of the spear of the state, was beefing up its every aspect, its surveillance ability, its computing ability, its analytical ability, writing tens of thousands of reports, and surveilling large sectors of American society. And you say, well, how does that happen? How could they possibly surveil me? Well, if you just talk about email for a minute, they had a program which intercepted emails that were going out of the country or into the country from foreign places. Well, the fact of the matter is that an awful lot of stuff comes through the United States from everywhere and through enormous fiber optic hubs and cables that go under the oceans. And all of this can be sorted and copies can be made. And companies like AT&T and Verizon, even Google and Apple got into the act. They have, but especially the telecommunications companies, up to a few years ago, they were supplying copies of all emails going in and out of the United States to the National Security Agency. So for someone like me, I'm a professor in my life, and I had hundreds of colleagues abroad. I'm sure that they were able to look into my personal email anytime they felt like it.
You know, it's just so extraordinary, all the ways in which the society has changed in an effort to, quote unquote, protect and preserve our liberties. I mean, it's interesting. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue with Dr. William Keller, author of Democracy Betrayed, The Rise of the Surveillance Security State. We'll be right back. indicated earlier that there are 17 agencies that are supposed to be responsible for the security of our country, along with other companies, other high-tech companies. 17 agencies? Do we need 17 agencies?
Well, you know, every major department has to have its own surveillance operation and its own intelligence keeping capability. So it sort of has grown, you know, a little bit at a time. And, of course, there's military intelligence, and there's the Army intelligence, and Navy intelligence, and Marine intelligence. There's the NSA and the FBI, and a few that you probably never heard of, some around nuclear weapons, lots of areas of our policy and society. And the result is that sort of the policy system and even the electoral system is becoming the focus of the intelligence, this secret intelligence activity. And we don't know why they do what they do. I was really appalled by the way in which the intelligence community inserted itself into the election this time, the presidential election. Now, of course, everyone knows that Mr. Comey came out and made a statement to the Congress about Hillary Clinton in the closing day, probably a pretty negative one, of the election, may have thrown the election. No one knows for sure, but it did affect the election. And then just right following the election, the intelligence community dug up some dirt that was circulating, really nasty stuff about Donald Trump and Russia, and probably not true, but they felt they should tell the president. So they went to I guess he was president-elect in Trump Tower, maybe on the first day of his presidency or the second day, right around there or right before. And, you know, the heads of the FBI, including Mr. Comey, who's 6'8", you know, and John Brennan, who was the CIA director and the director of national intelligence and the director of the National Security Agency, all confronted this, our new president. Now, I don't care what you think of the new president. They confronted him and said, look, we've got compromising material on. We've got compromise. We think you should know about it. But the other thing, and I imagine how, you know, the president must have felt. He must have felt, you know, with salacious material being given him by his intelligence chiefs. He probably was pretty much taken aback by that. And then the whole thing has continued. We have the intelligence community doing counterterrorism and criminal investigations of the president's team, and they're testifying before the Congress. So you could say that not only the election was influenced by the intelligence community in the United States, but also the transition and also the viability of the incoming administration. I mean, President Trump started off with a feud with his intelligence community. So who's calling the shots here, right? Is it the elected representatives of the people? Or is it maybe some people who haven't been elected, maybe been appointed, but they control vast bureaucracies which have a lot of power and are indeed able to kill people if they want to, if they need to?
Again, chilling. You have also said that there are activities taking place that are contrary to the rule of law, which is a lovely way of saying it's illegal. They're doing crooked, illegal stuff. And who's to stop them? Who's to know?
Yeah, well, I like the way you put it. I should have let you edit my book. Maybe next time. But say just a little more about your question, because I'd like to hear just a minute more if I can.
Well, you've identified some of these things that have happened by the intelligence community, some of which are, you've said, contrary to the rule of law. I say they're crooked.
You say they're crooked. No, yeah. And I say contrary to the rule of law because I was thinking the rule of law broadly. Now, let me tell you what I'm thinking. I think, for instance, that drone attacks that target people and kill them in countries like Yemen or other, well, that turns out to be a lot of Islamic majority countries, or countries where there are a lot of people of color, predominantly. These drone attacks are assassinations. And these assassinations didn't occur much at all before President Bush. Again, it's the technology coming along. The drone technology has been ripping along with the surveillance technology, and they've been combined. Then Barack Obama made it a policy of the United States to hunt down terrorists, so-called terrorists, and kill them. And we even killed some American citizens. And the British have done the same thing. They've killed British citizens. This is, you know, without a trial. This is based on intelligence information. And the other thing is there's been a lot of what they call collateral damage. And collateral damage is really a nice term for killing women and children, innocent women and children, and men, of course. Sometimes, you know, they get a bad tip, and they just blow up a mosque, and there's a lot of people worshiping in there, or something of that nature. So that's where I would say there's a certain lawlessness taking place abroad, where we're just killing thousands of people without any kind of due process. But there's also a kind of lawlessness at home, where we don't use due process on people because the information against them is classified. And this is the whole problem of secrecy. And I think it goes straight to something that was in the New York Times today, and I urge you all to read it. This is an article on Dr. Jessen and Dr. Mitchell, who were the guys that dreamt up and created the CIA torture program. Now, this program went on from about 2002 to 2005 or 6, and it was thoroughly investigated by the Senate and deemed to be illegal and then dismantled in theory. And this program, the United States really did torture people in many countries of the world at what we call black sites. And some of them were in Cuba, at Guantanamo Bay, the most famous one, I think. But there were others in Afghanistan or various countries around the world. It's kind of classified where they are. It leaks out a bit at a time. But this is a kind of violation not only of the Geneva Conventions, international laws, but basic principles at the heart of the American Constitution. Principles like due process, like the right not to incriminate yourself. These are very, very important things. A trial by a jury, the right to face your accusers. None of these, I would say, luxuries of liberal democracy now were afforded to the people that they thought were terrorists and had rounded up after 9/11. Some of them are still at Guantanamo Base. And it turns out that a number of the people were just picked up and they had nothing to do with anything. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And they were tortured summarily, too, along with people who might have actually committed crimes. So these guys, Mitchell and his partner had a firm, and they got some $81 million for helping the CIA create this program. Now, there are a couple of problems with this. One is the CIA had no idea how to run such a program. So they basically chartered it out to other people. And these people couldn't be controlled. So this is a great blight on our democratic system, on our judicial system, its inability to stop rogue CIA operations. And it's also a consequence of, really a whole new topic, and I can just suggest it, and if you want to talk about it, we can. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. You'll have to edit this one out.
Well, let me just go back. I mean, you were about to bring up a topic that you thought we might discuss in a bit, but I just want to go back for a second to something you said a few moments ago. You characterized the use of drones as assassinations, but there are many people who would say that the use of drones is saving American lives. So how do you respond to those folks?
Well, you know, the question is, you know, what I would have to have the specifics. I'd like to know what American lives are saved. And they probably say it's empowering the national security. And then I would say, well, protecting the national security, and I would have to say, well, what is the national security? What does that mean to protect it? To me, it just looks like a military action run by a supposedly civilian organization. Now, it's true that the Department of Defense has its own drone program, and the CIA has their own program, and they probably ought to be consolidated, but it's hard to see how going against our basic values as a nation, which is you're innocent until proven guilty, all the things we all learned in civics classes or in grade school or from our parents, it's hard to see how you abandon all that and still have a democracy, a functioning democracy at home. If you're willing to say, okay, well, this guy's an American citizen, but you know we don't like the way he's talking, so shoot a Haram missile at him and blow up his house. So I do think that there is, you know, a problem with security, and the problem is that people always want more security. And the other half of that is that kind of unscrupulous people, politicians, many politicians, use the fear of terrorism to frighten the people enough so they can get other programs through, so they can get more and more resources for the intelligence community, more and more drones, bigger budgets, more power, more latitude in what they can do in the society. The fact of the matter is, you don't have to be very concerned in your life about terrorism. You really don't. Terrorism in the United States, since 9/11, has been almost non-existent. You have to sort it out from gun violence, of course. We can't say, anytime anybody walks into a nightclub and shoots everybody, that's terrorism, but maybe it's just a crazy person, right? Someone who's deranged and so on. So I really think that we are beginning to change the character of our society by allowing ourselves to be really afraid of something that we really don't need to be afraid of. And I could put it another way. The chances of the average person being hurt by a terrorist or killed by a terrorist are kind of less than being hit by a falling airplane part.
Well, that certainly, that puts a different perspective on it. And, you know, the other thing that is certainly true and with growing concern is that in communities of color, certainly locally, nationally, internationally, the motto now seems to be guilty until proven innocent. Versus what is supposed to be our value, one of our core values of innocent until proven otherwise. So, you know, all of this gets to be really quite concerning. And
there's also, if I may just say one thing, there's also the whole issue of secret courts. You know, we have the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Court. It's a secret court. It meets in secret. It has judges, but it doesn't have anyone to represent you. It meets usually with a representative of the government, of the FBI or the CIA, and or the Justice Department. And they ask the court, they say, can we have a surveillance to go and check out these people? And the court usually says yes. In fact, out of like 4,000 cases, Only about less than 1%, not even 40, were rejected. So it's a rubber stamp operation, and this court. You know, my view of this is that secret courts can't be secret. You got to have the doors open. You got to see what justice is going on, and a guy needs to be able to walk in and see what's happening in his brother's case. You can't have secret documents which are used against you, which you're not allowed to see and. All this kind of thing. Secret courts are really the harbingers of tyranny everywhere, and that's something we've got to watch very closely in this country.
And for a long time, I would suggest, please correct me if I'm incorrect, that many people weren't even aware of the FISA court and that whole operation. I don't think we even knew about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the courts were quite secret, and you can read about them in a very complex law, which if you're a lawyer, perhaps you can get through it. But the fact of the matter is, in these courts, there's no no one who says, no, we don't want to do this. There's no adversarial relationship going on. It's just a very hand-in-glove thing where an agent of the government, could be any part of the government, Justice Department, goes to the judge and says, I want to put a wiretap on this class of people, this whole bunch of people who live in New York, because we think they've been talking to foreign agents. Well, so they do that, and then they pick up all kinds of information they're not supposed to have. Like, they find out about all kinds of things that people are doing. And maybe they're criminal things, and maybe they're not. Maybe they're just things they don't want them to do. But that's not how our society proceeds, right? Our society is supposed to proceed where you charge a person with a crime. And then you bring the evidence against him. The person has a chance to defend himself and bring their evidence in an adversarial proceeding. But what happens in a lot of these things is they find out about a crime or a suspect thing through eavesdropping, and then they send the police or a SWAT team there. And who knows how that's going to go, right? So okay. It's interesting that the power of the courts is somewhat diminished in what I call secure democracy, the kind of democracy we're becoming. Courts are becoming relatively less important in many areas, especially in surveillance. And it's very hard to get the Supreme Court to do much in that area. So,
well, and you've said that secret within the secure democracy concept that you're talking about, the secret state interests are above the privacy concerns of citizens. So, again, there is in the interest of allegedly creating extreme safety, what has happened to us as individuals is significantly less privacy and less safety.
Well, I think that's actually right, and I would. One of the things we need to think about is the role that secrecy plays in all of this, and we're not talking, Pamela, about just a few people who have security clearances like I did. We're talking about over a million people in government and in agencies, in contracting agencies, have a top secret clearance. And you have to ask, these are a million government employees, a million people employed by the government. What are they talking about that's top secret? And it goes top secret, secret, and confidential clearances. And there are several million people who have secret clearances. So a great proportion, a very large proportion of people who work for the government are now dealing with secret papers that eventually will probably never make the light of day, but they'll have actual effects on the society. Every once in a while, the ACLU or one of the other watchdog agencies, the Electronic Privacy Association, or one of those, they can pry out some of these documents through the Freedom of Information Act. But the fact is that democracy works best when any citizen can get any law and talk about it, and it gets written about in the papers, not when government has hundreds of thousands of employees who are actually working on things that are secret that the people aren't allowed to see. And it's kind of a question of numbers. If there were just 10 people doing this, we'd say, great. If there were just 1,000 people doing it, we'd say, well, probably okay. But a million people working at a top secret level and working on things that, if they disclose them, they go to jail. So it's a whole universe of secrecy, which is inimical to democratic process and democratic society.
William, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like for you to talk about the use of terror as a political tool. And then I'd like for us to figure out what we need to do about all of this.
Absolutely.
In 10 words or less, okay? Just be warned. Okay. Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back.
Okay. We'll be right back.
William, you've expressed concern that terror is used as a political tool. How so?
Well, let me be very careful how I state this. So let's look from the outside of the United States, and there's a terrorist group. There's a group. Say it's Al-Qaeda or one of the others that's less known. So they're using terror as a political instrument because they can, what is politics? It's the ability to enforce your will on other people, basically. Make the laws and do what you want to do with the society. So in that case, terror is used as a political instrument. And I think that there is a concerted effort by terrorist organizations to use terror in a way that it creates problems for the West, okay? Now, if you think of it from another perspective, we use terror in the United States to build empires. And what I mean by that is empires within different agencies. And basically, we use the threat of terror to gain more and more power and more money and to use a greater proportion of our government resources for counterterror. Counterterror operations that may be completely unnecessary. So now, of course, there is the other argument that people get into, and they say, well, you know, the reason we haven't had, much terrorism since 9/11 is that all the counterterror has worked. And that's a tough argument, but if you look at the facts about how many terrorist incidents there were in the United States, if you start in 1970, 1969, there were a tremendous number, hundreds of them. And the line just drops down to 9/11, and then this is the number of incidents, and it continues to drop after 9/11 all the way to the present day. So in the United States, there have been, probably 5 years or 6 years since 9/11 where there was no terrorist event, nothing. So, but during those years, still, the threat of terrorism was used to beef up the budgets and the political power of the NSA counterterror operations, of the FBI counterterror operations, and really counterterror operations of the whole network of, this is hundreds of buildings and tens of thousands of people dedicated to this. So, use of terror as a political instrument? Sure. The terrorists use it. That's the only political instrument they have. Use of terror or the fear of terror is also a political instrument that people use unwisely use in the United States and in Great Britain and France so that the people are afraid and we'll let them do what they want to do. It's pretty much that simple. Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, may be able to now institute some really draconian legislation limiting what can be on the Internet, what can go on Facebook, what can go on WhatsApp, and giving government back doors into it, simply because there were two terrorist events leading up to the legislation. So if that gets put in place, then the society really will be hobbled because they will make Google and Facebook and take down all kinds of web pages and they will be saying, the government will force the companies to say, who can be on the Internet and who can't. So you see, it's a slippery slope.
It is indeed. It's interesting because I'm not sure that just as a people, we tend to really think about the power of fear versus reality. And what you're clearly saying is that fear has been and may likely continue to be one of the most powerful, certainly psychological tools that the government has.
And it is eroding democracy, but it's not doing it in, it is overall eroding democracy, but the point of contact is really, let me put it this way. Nice upper middle class white people are not going to be challenged very much by the security state. They're going to be left alone because they have money, they can hire lawyers, they can do whatever they want. People who live who are less fortunate, who are living with a lot less money, who are struggling to get by, they're the ones likely to have somebody come and smash their door down.
Right.
Or, surveil what they're going on because these people are angry. So we may see that this whole counterterrorism turns into a method of social control which would, this is what I'm afraid of, which would focus first on persons of color and people with very little money, and it would really change the nature of our democracy. And I think that's really why I wrote the book, to try and lay out what some of the warning signs were and where I think we're headed. I can clearly see that I'm a lot less free today than I was 25 years ago.
So what do we do?
Okay, so that's always the hard part, right? Well, you're doing a good thing by interviewing me today and at least letting my views go out, and I really appreciate that. And I spent 5 years of my life holed up in a room writing a book. So there's two things we can do. People like you in the media who have such a influence on the society can keep working with these topics and so that people really understand what's going on and know when their rights are being taken away. I also think that we can really support, there's an organization called EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Association. There's a couple of privacy organizations. There's the American Civil Liberties Union. If you have, $25, give it to them. And they'll start sending you emails to explain to you how they're trying to figure out how to stop the government from doing this. So I think broad-based education and just people saying, well, wait a minute, I want to use my iPhone the way I want to use it. I don't want somebody being able to build a back door into it. And another thing people can do, and a lot of you younger people I want to speak to now because you would have the way to do it, you'd know how to do it, you can encrypt everything. You can use strong encryption on your iPhones so that you know that when, or your smartphone of any kind, really Samsung would be just as good, just put strong encryption on it so that nobody can possibly get into your phone, and if they do get into your phone, they can't read what you're talking about because they don't have the encryption program. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to for people to sort of make it very clear to their representatives. We're going to use the tools of democracy to fight for democracy. That's what we have to do. And make it clear to your representatives. When things calm down a bit, you can't do anything this week, but next week, call your representative's office and say, look, I'm really concerned about my personal privacy and some of the things that are going on. And just, make your voice be felt, because that's the only way, that's the only thing that politicians really respond to. And one of the things, that a statistic that always gets me, is that when you ask people generally, what are the chances, what's the percentage chance do you think that you will be the victim of a terrorist attack, or some close friend or your family member will be a victim? And the answer, yes or no. And about 55% answer, yes, I think I will be. Well, that's just wrong. And we have to rethink the whole thing, because, if you think about terrorism, there haven't been 200 terrorist deaths since 9/11. And yet since 9/11, 350,000 people died in auto accidents. So, maybe we should take those parts of government that are doing all this surveillance and dismantle parts of it and decrease their budgets and begin to look at some of the things that matter to people. Are there enough playgrounds for kids? Are people getting the food that they need? Are kids getting nutritious food at school? Are they in safe environments? These are the things, education, and are there good jobs out there? These are the things that we need to be working on in our society, not worrying about whether somebody got radicalized as a jihadi and now is going to go out and drive a truck into three or four people. I just think that if you turn the clock back 25 years, nobody was concerned at all about terrorism, and yet there was just as much terrorism as there is today. So something has happened in our society, and I think that we can use the organizations that are able to pry things out of the secret documents out into the public arena. And citizens can when new security is put on at your school or someplace, ask why it's necessary. and what the reason is, and try not to be emotional. As, you know, most schools don't need a lot of protection. They may need one security guard, you know, to challenge people who come on the school grounds, that kind of thing. But you certainly don't need a whole bunch of people toting automatic weapons. And that's one other thing I just wanted to mention, because it's kind of emblematic of what's happened to us. When I was worked for the Congress, I walked to work. I worked four blocks away. I worked as a security analyst for a non-partisan agency of Congress. It's called the Office of Technology Assessment. And we could walk, and my children were born at that time too, three children, a girl and two and twin boys. And I used to take my kids on walks, and I'd take them to the Capitol building, so we lived right four blocks away. And we just go through, you have to put your stuff through a machine, but you could go in. And the Capitol building is full of beautiful rooms and ornate ceilings and sculptures, and it tells the whole story of our history. You can even go, you used to be able to go right to the Senate chambers and almost the Senate cloakrooms. You could actually see democracy in action to the citizen. And there were millions of people who went through this building. Now nobody gets to go through it. The Capitol building is off limits to anyone except 535 elected officials and their friends. The halls are cavernous, and you can't get in. So that's a very big symbol, that now you go to a visitor center that's adjacent to the Capitol, actually underground, that's where you go. Whereas before 9/11, you could walk right into the Capitol building and see your history and look at various precious documents and things that are national treasures that we own. But now, unfortunately, a few senators and a few congressmen are enjoying it. So that gives me a kind of a picture to say to Americans, let's open the Capitol building. That'd be a good thing to do. Let's get it reopened so that you can take your children there. They can see it.
One of the comments that you also make in Democracy Betrayed is the following. You say, in the contest between liberty and security, there will never be a balance. Liberty must always be privileged over security.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, let me tell you what my thought about that is that as much as I admired President Barack Obama, he always used to try and balance liberty concerns with security concerns. And what happens is that liberty concerns go out the window very quickly, and security concerns usually win. So what we have to do is we have to say, well, security is everywhere, right? You can't go anywhere without seeing a person with a gun and a uniform.
Right.
So it's everywhere around us, and sometimes we feel very good about it. But if security becomes so strong that it begins to overwhelm liberty, and it almost always will if there's too much security. So I say, when we think about if we're going to have more liberty and more security, let's always say, let's start with the liberty first and then add a little security where it's needed. Let's not start with a $120 billion budget for security purposes, internal security, and then see if we can still define a few areas where liberty can survive. It can't.
And certainly with, you know, the kind of budgets that these organizations have, it's in their best interest to create the fear that allows them to grow and grow.
Right. And, you know, I'm not saying that these are bad people. They're probably some of your friends and my friends. And Lord knows I wrote letters and got a lot of my students into the agencies over the years. I felt that if they had my perspective at least tucked in there somewhere, they might be helpful. So I tried to get them in. So I think that, you know, we need to look very closely at what is the real need for security at home. And then if there's not a need for it, let's dump that and not worry about it so much. I mean, in the extreme, I mean, do you think that everyone in this country really wants to have every stoplight monitored by a camera, and then anybody who doesn't stop at the stoplight or rolls through an orange a little few feet too soon, or behind, gets a ticket in the mail. You see, it's going to be possible to control almost every aspect of our behavior. For example, you could go to a Kroger store, and they will know everything that you bought if you have a Kroger card. And they can tell a huge amount about you by what you eat. And they take this data, and they put it together with other data sources, and pretty soon there's a profile on you. And that's why you end up getting ads for things that you're thinking about when you're on the Internet.
Right.
Because they've identified you, and they figured it out, and the government's identified you. So now that we have this fabulous digital technology, we need to figure out how to limit it. So, and this is one of the things you asked me, how do we need to limit its use. How do we privilege liberty over security? And one way to do it is to manage the technologies a lot better and just say, well, there's certain surveillance technologies that we're just not going to let the government have. And there are certain ways in which we're not going to let them use the technology. And that's really best, because otherwise the authorities are going to know there's big markets in this data. You know, people buy it and sell it all over the place. If we don't sort of put a lid on this, the authorities will know what you eat, who you go out with, who your friends are, when you're on the Internet at a site that's a little bit more lively than your wife might like. All kinds of things, your browsing history, all these things become permanent records assigned to you. And the question is, who gets to see these records? And,
exactly.
And in fact, why are they being made? Why are they being held? Why do we have to know the browsing histories of Americans? We don't need to know that. And so we should build machines that dump the browsing histories regularly, or at least make them encrypted so that nobody can know your browsing history except yourself. Right. I mean, I must have a very, very funny browsing history. I'm always browsing terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and all kinds of things.
You might need to be a little careful.
I know.
Dr. Keller, I could continue to talk to you endlessly. However, time today is not my friend, and we do have to wrap it up here. But is there a website for the work that you do? Is there some way for people to continue to follow your work and your interests?
Well, I think you're very kind. As a matter of fact, I'm just building a website now, but I can't give it to you. If you want to get the book, go to the Counterpoint Press website, and you can get an electronic copy or buy a copy of the book. Or you could get it on Amazon too. And I appreciate that. And then next time we talk, I'll give you a digital address.
Excellent. And I look forward to the next time we talk. Thank you again so much. Dr. William W. Keller, author of Democracy Betrayed, The Rise of the Surveillance Security State.
And thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. You can also subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via the iTunes Store. You can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send me an email with any questions or comments you have about any of the Mind Talk programs. And by all means, please remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.